So Brooks Richards, real six. The radio communications that were being used at the time were agent-type portmanteau sets, and he decided that this disabled submarine was such an attractive target for the RAF that he would break radio silence and by reporting the target's existence. So he tried desperately to make contact with SIS's base station and was on the air for a very long time trying to do so while this ship was towed out round the buoy at Amen, and we were lurking in the offing. But contact was never made. There was no response the other end. So, in fact, the bombing never took place. But it does illustrate his guts. He felt he just couldn't let a good target like that go by just in order to preserve his own radio silence. Well,
what date did you say this mission was?
This would have been in August 1942. And I can't without... I have no doubt that the relevant files in the PRO would show the date of the operation. And if I ever come to write it up, I'll probably have to go and check those. But Lomonek's credited in René Hugon's book with having been involved in all in some 30 operations, not all by fishing boat, some by high-speed craft on the North Coast, and probably some of those would have been submarine on the West Coast as well. But anyhow, this very important run of success was vital to SIS at the time, and the last thing they wanted was to have SOE endangering it. And it was decided, really, that it was worthwhile building boats that would look like fishing boats but go a great deal faster in order to carry out this traffic down the West Coast better. And a vessel on the lines of the P-11, but with an underwater body that was that of a high-speed powered craft, was built at Groves and Guttridge in Cowes, Isle of Wight, a rather specialist firm who used to build lifeboats. They still do so, for all I know. And the design for this vessel came from the board of Jack Laurent Giles, who was a very well-known yacht designer, but serving during the war in Director of Naval Constructions Department. And when the high-speed replica of P-11 was nearly ready for delivery, the yard was bombed and she was burnt, and they had to build a second one. So there was a great delay in getting this boat out. And she never appeared before I had left for the Mediterranean in the autumn of 1942. But though there's quite a certain amount about Lomonek in Hampshire's secret navies, he does not go on to record the disaster that finally brought his run of success to an end, because though this happened when I was in the Mediterranean, I heard about it soon enough, he took this high-speed version of the P-11 down to the Glenau area. This must have been 1943 rather than 42, I think. And he carried out an operation down there, and he then used his main engines and gave her speed before he was sufficiently clear of the coast in daylight. Was spotted by the Germans, who realized exactly what was happening, and all his family was arrested. And I believe none of them came back. He was so conscience-stricken by this disaster that he opted out of special operations totally, and I think joined a French corvette, Free French corvette, and spent the rest of the war in ordinary anti-submarine duties. But he survived the war and is still alive today down the west coast of France, though I haven't seen him for many years. But he's never published a book. It would be a fascinating story if he'd done so. But anyhow, having as background this conflict of interest, there were personality conflicts as well grafted on top of it, because Holdsworth was a very independent, tough-minded fellow, and he regarded Slocum with great mistrust, and Slocum regarded him as a hothead and with great mistrust. I was at that stage acceptable to all parties, and Slocum's people invited me really to join them, and had I done so, the rest of the story would have been rather different. But I didn't really feel I could leave behind all the ratings that I'd been working with in Holdsworth, so I thanked them very much and said, no, I'd rather stick with NIDQ instead of joining NIDC. And not long after this, we were sent at Helford for a visit by our naval section in London, a certain Lieutenant Commander Cardell Ryan, RN, alias Abdullah Bey, who we had all heard of as a member of SOE's naval section, who'd been operating in the Red Sea. And Cardell Ryan had been a regular naval sub-lieutenant in the First World War, and he had left the Navy shortly after that and had spent the interwar years in the Red Sea as a captain of dhows with Somali crews. I'd be very surprised if he hadn't been, if he wasn't a homosexual. At any rate, he became, he as it were, went native. He spoke Arabic and no doubt Somali, and became a Muslim. And I imagine that his career out there must have been very like that of a French smuggler and buccaneer called Henri de Montfried, who wrote a very good book called Pearls, Arms and Hashish, subsequently, about arms smuggling in the Red Sea, which I remember appeared just before the war. But Cardell Ryan stayed out in the Red Sea in this obviously lucrative and very odd highly piratical trade until the war, when he was mobilized and, as a regular naval officer, became lieutenant commander, given his years. And he had performed a most unusual feat. At a time when the East African campaign was nearing its end, and it was known that two Axis ships of some size were bottled up in Massawa, and it was likely that they would make a bolt for the Indian Ocean, that they would do so through French territorial waters off Djibouti, which was still in the hands of Vichy. Well, the naval authorities in Aden couldn't systematically violate Vichy French neutrality by sending destroyers to lie in wait every night for these two ships. And they hit upon the compromise of sending Cardinal Ryan with two local dhows, neither of them with an engine, to anchor in French territorial waters, to raise the alarm if they spotted these ships making for the Indian Ocean, at which stage, no doubt, the destroyers were prepared to go in and tackle them, notwithstanding Vichy neutrality. Well, Cardinal Ryan's two dhows had Somali crews, and apart from Bren guns and small arms, their only armament was a 3-pounder gun of the type fitted to naval picket boats from the 1890s onwards. And Cardinal Ryan was the only man who knew on his particular boat that he sailed on, the only man who knew how to lay and fire this gun. But he was on station anchored off Djibouti one night and taking a nap when his coxswain, Nakada, as I think they're called locally, woke him up and said, "Steamship, steamship." And he looked out and there was an absolutely enormous vessel bearing down almost on top of them. So they cut the grass warp to which they were lying with an axe, and you can't tack a dhow, so they had to hoist sail and make a circle round. And while all this was going on, Cardinal Ryan took a couple of shots with his 3-pounder gun, and there was quite a swell running, so that the first shot went off about maximum elevation, and the second one went off about maximum depression, and he felt convinced that no good would cover them. But then there was a sort of muffled roar, and by the time they got sail up and came round again to the same spot, there was a lifeboat with a lot of people on board it and no steamship. So he thought, good God, I've sunk a British ship or a French ship. And he hailed them first in English and then in French. But it turned out, in fact, that they were Germans. And he had, well, at any rate, he took the lifeboat in tow, covered it with a Bren gun, towed it into Pirim Island, which was serving as base for him at the time, and he had sunk a German ship of 9,000 or 10,000 tons, I may be wrong about her name, but I think she was called the Drachenfels. Anyhow, he was put up for a DSO on the strength of this extraordinary achievement. It emerged that the first shot he had fired had struck the foremast head and had knocked the masthead and the cross trees down onto the bridge, killing the captain. The second shot had hit in the engine room where the scuttling charges were placed, and these had been detonated, sinking the ship.
And this was one of the warships that was bottled up in Massawa, wasn't it?
This was not a warship, she was a merchant ship, bottled up in Massawa, and making her break, and he destroyed her with these two extraordinary fluky shots. But he never got the DSO because he was with the end of the East African campaign. At that point, he was put on to running cargoes in Levant schooners of one sort or another into Tobruk, which was then under siege. And this was very risky business with the petrol stored down in the bottom of the hold and the bully reef on top, so that when they got machine-gunned, the petrol wouldn't automatically be hit, as they nearly always did get machine-gunned from the air. But he was on this run for some time. But while he was in Alexandria, his behavior came to the notice of higher authority, too much swinging on chandeliers and one thing and another. And Admiral A.B. Cunningham, Sir Andrew Cunningham, took such an unfavorable view of what he'd been up to that he quashed the recommendation for the DSO, and he sent Abdullah Bey home to England with a recommendation he'd be no further employed. Well, SOE's naval section, and I can't at the moment remember whether it was in the hands of Admiral Holcomb, retired admiral, or somebody else at that moment, but they sent him down to Helford to see how we were operating and exchange experiences with us, and he spent a couple of pleasant days with us, went off back to London, and not long thereafter, this would have been in September or possibly even early October, September probably, 42. I was sent for to report to the naval section in London and to bring my kit with me. So at any rate, I left Helford in a hurry, where my wife had joined me. She'd been at Bletchley with working on the linguistics of the German submarine decryptions. But she was down at Helford right with me at the time, so I reported up in London and was told that that an awkward situation had arisen because Cardinal Ryan, alias Abdullah Bey, had been found in a bar somewhere off Trafalgar Square discussing the impending Allied landing in French North Africa with a lot of Poles. And this was considered such a serious matter that he was being sent to the Outer Hebrides, to an establishment that SOE kept for keeping people who were regarded as security risks away from contact with anybody else, and to be up there for quite a long time.
What was the name of it?
Well, I don't know where it was. It was somewhere up on the west coast of Scotland. I said, well, that was fine, but what... they'd also discovered that the intention was that once the Allied landing, the impending Allied landing in Algeria had taken place, and the 1st and the 8th armies had joined up, there would be a united naval command of the whole Mediterranean, and that the commander-in-chief would be Andrew B. Cunningham. And Well, it was decided that it perhaps would be a bad idea to have Abdullah Bey facing him as SOE's naval representative in the Western Mediterranean. Anyway, so would I please get me out to Gibraltar as quickly as possible, and I would be given details locally there, but the problem was to run guns into Algiers to prepare for the Allied landing. Now, I can't pinpoint the dates at the minute. This would require more search, at which I flew to Algeria. I flew to Gibraltar. But I got there. This certainly occurred after the main convoys had left Scotland and probably other ports as well, like Liverpool, to rendezvous with the American invasion force that was going to Casablanca and which was mounted directly from the United States. And they were taking a rather circuitous route round. They had to go out to 17 West and then come down south before turning into the Mediterranean. So my flight out must have been, that journey would have taken them, I would think, not less than 10 days. Sometime in the fortnight, let's say, before the Allied landings on the 8th of November, and certainly, therefore, sometime at the very end of October, I flew out to Gibraltar, and found the local SOE officer in charge, a man called Brian Clark, who was a New Zealander, who was working closely with OSS in their first overseas venture, since the Americans had still consular posts in French North Africa under Robert Murphy, and OSS officers deployed in these consular posts, the first overseas deployment, as I've said, of OSS agents. And the senior OSS officer who was in Tangier was a man called Bill Eddy, who was an American Arabist, son of missionary parents, who I think had been teaching at the American University in Beirut before the war. But he and Brian Clark were working very closely together, and SOE had been asked by OSS to prepare weaponry and explosives, but chiefly guns, to be landed in Algiers for the little resistance with which OSS and Murphy, a little resistance group with which they were in contact. And the material in question, of which SOE had about 600 tons in Gibraltar at the time, stored in the tunnels into the rock, that were very, very extensive already at that time. We had to pack all this stuff up, make a selection of what was most likely to be useful, and the captain who was in charge of this store, whose name escapes me at the minute, but was subsequently washed overboard from a cruiser on his way up to Algiers. But anyway, we got the material ready, and then I embarked it on a vessel of about 400 tons belonging to Slocum, called the Minna, that had been a Scottish fishery protection vessel in peacetime, and had a quite decent speed of, I should think, about 14 knots. Twin-screw vessel, rather like a motor yacht in general appearance and outline, with a funnel, and she would have been, I don't know what, but certainly over 100 feet long. Oh, well over 100 feet long, because she's 400 tons. But she was commanded by a Royal Naval Reserve officer called Armstrong, and I think she'd been on some kind of local patrol duties when she wasn't required by Slocum, or Slocum had borrowed her especially for the job. I'm not quite sure, but she did subsequently work for him again. But we set off in the very early days of November for Algiers in the Minna. I, as the SOE conducting officer responsible for the operation, Armstrong obviously in command of his own ship, and we were given a rendezvous east of Cherchel, which is the place where Mark Clark had gone ashore from a submarine at almost exactly that time. Now, Brian Clark's subsequent report to SOE on SOE and their involvement in the landings is a document of which I've got a copy, interestingly enough. But he pinpoints the date of our attempts to land this material as the nights of the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of November, which is to say, only a matter of, depending on which of those dates you are talking about, 4 or 5 days prior to the actual landing taking place. But the situation in OSS in Algiers and in Murphy's, Consulate General at the time, must have been extremely confused, because Murphy had been working with a small group in Algiers, all of which is going to be reported in some detail in a book that Anthony Verrier is present reading, writing, and has already been treated by Professor Arthur Funk in another book that he wrote some years ago. But I don't need to go into it in much detail, therefore, but the complication of the situation was that you had, as actual resistance material on the ground, a very small group in Algiers of something not exceeding 200, largely refugees from France, and a majority of them Jewish in background, who got up